Kia ora and welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, we take a look at progress with reforms proposed for the New Zealand health system. These arose from the report of the Health and Disability System Review Panel, aka the Simpson Report. However, they have been significantly revved up by Health Minister Andrew Little to become what I like to call the Big Little Revolution. On System Fix, I speak with regular panellists and invited guests about the changes, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for joining me. Kia ora, and welcome to System Fix, Episode 20. It's Rob Campbell and 1st of July. This episode, you have me providing a recap of all things 1 July and an interview between senior journalist Martin Johnson and Health New Zealand Board Chair Rob Campbell. But more about that later. First, a recap of recent news. The big day, which has been circled on so many calendars for so long, arrived. 1 July, the end of district health boards and the starting point for a new system based on the recommendations of the Simpson Report, that is, the Health and Disability System Review Panel report, the recommendations of the Y2575 report, the Waitangi Tribunal investigation into inequity in primary care outcomes, and last but not least, a bit of spicing up by Health Minister Andrew Little to provide the Big Little Revolution. Unfortunately, after months of anticipation, I wasn't able to attend the launch event due to a personal commitment. The day started with a dawn ceremony at Waitangi, releasing the new names of the central agencies, Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand and Te Aka Wai Ora, the Māori Health Authority. In a joint media release, Health Ministers Andrew Little and Pene Hanare said the new names
reflect the Māori Crown partnership and intent to deliver for all New Zealanders, including Māori, with the focus on a health system grounded in Te Tiriti o Waitangi.
They go on to say,
Te Aka Whai Ora, the Māori Health Authority, is an equal partner at the heart of the new health system. It is able to co-commission and plan services across the system with Te Whatu Ora, Health New Zealand, as well as commission its own kaupapa Māori services. Iwi Māori partnership boards will ensure whānau have a real voice in development of services which can be tailored to better reflect those who need and use them.
End of quote. And not the Minister speaking. The Ministers are clearly spelling out the role of the new Māori Health Authority and partnership boards in the face of criticisms the changes create separate health systems. They do not. The official launch saw the agency's interim boards become fully fledged, and with that, each board lost two members. Chris Tooley and Lady Tariki Moxon are no longer on the Māori Health Authority board, and Mark Goshi and Cassandra Crowley have left Health New Zealand. In both cases, the Minister says this is to make way for additional skills on the two boards. Sharon Shea, who has been co-chair of the Māori Health Authority with Tipa Mahuta and on the board of Health NZ, is now only on the authority board, with Ms Mahuta becoming sole chair and taking a seat on the Health NZ board. Keeping up? Closer to the front line of health, 1 July saw the creation of Hauora Tai Whenua, a new rural health advocacy network arising from the merger of the Rural General Practice Network and other organisations representing both rural health workforces and rural communities. All of this in partnership with the network's treaty partner, Te Rōpū Ārahi. The disability sector saw its dream of a standalone ministry come to fruition on 1st of July. Whaikaha, the Ministry of Disabled People, was officially launched. The creation of the ministry has been driven by disability sector concern about yet again playing second fiddle to health services. The Office for Disability Issues, which is currently administered by MSD, will be folded into the new ministry. 1 July, a busy day, also saw the release of the Interim Government Policy Statement on Health 2022 to 2024. This statement is one of the key documents mentioned in the Paiora Healthy Futures Act, along with the New Zealand Health Plan, Health Charter, Locality Plans, and a number of sector strategies. The Act requires the Health Minister to issue a policy at least once every 3 years, setting the priorities for the publicly funded health sector and the health plan. In this interim statement, the government commits itself to making, quote, measurable progress, end of quote, in attaining equitable health and wellbeing outcomes for Māori by 2024. It includes some actual measurements for checking. ethnic and geographical variation in access to colonoscopies, in access to specialist mental health services, in missed appointments for specialist care, and in the rate of diabetes complications. Hot on the heels of the new agencies, attention turned to a new system for delivering the public health services that protect the population from disease. On the 4th of July, a flex was planted in Wellington to mark a new public health agency sitting inside the Ministry of Health and a new National Public Health Service sitting inside Health NZ. Former Northland DHB Chief Executive and GP Nick Chamberlain leads that service, which brings together the existing 12 public health units, the Health Promotion Agency, and a few Ministry of Health functions, including screening, immunisation and COVID-19 response services. In the month leading up to the 1st of July deadline, here at New Zealand Doctor Rite Aotearoa, we embarked on a sterling effort to attend as many of the final board meetings of the DHBs as possible. We weren't 100% successful by any stretch. Many of the boards had done their dash by the end of May. In June, reporters attended the final gatherings of the boards of Lakes, Capital and Coast and Hutt Valley, West Coast, Hawke's Bay, Tairāwhiti, Mid-Central and Auckland. The meetings were characterised by thanks, tears, laughter and expressions of pride and disappointment. The final meeting of the Nelson Marlborough DHB did not have adequate Zoom facilities. We were told it was going to be a short affair. The final meetings of Bay of Plenty Counties, Manukau and Wairarapa DHBs were closed to the public. There's a surprise. Waikato has held all its board meetings in private since the Commissioner was appointed in May 2019. The other boards had already met back in May before we started on our final assault. By 5th of July, the ball was well and truly in the court of Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand. DHB email sign-offs had been replaced by Te Whatu Ora, as had Twitter handles, and the buck had shifted, as witnessed by former County's Manukau DHB Chair Mark Goshi, stating that responsibility for investigating the death of a woman at Middlemore Hospital ED now lay with Te Whatu Ora. At the final Mid-Central DHB board meeting, reporter Amanda Cameron heard that while the 20 DHBs and their deficits had been wiped, there would continue to be budgets specifically for each former DHB area in the coming financial year. Te Whatu Ora confirmed the 2022-23 budgets for the new system have been prepared using the former DHB and Shared Service Agency organisation structures. Te Whatu Ora Chief Financial Officer Rosalie Percival says the 2022-23 overall budget has been presented to the board for approval. So there you have it, a potted summary of what's been happening. The focus is still firmly on hospital services, and I expect in coming weeks, workforce will be top of the agenda. As for primary care, there's work going on with localities, but it's very early days, even for the prototype localities, and folk are pretty tight-lipped on process and progress. I expect largely because this is new territory and the game plan is being made up as we go along. The transition unit will now be doing its own transitioning, with its contract due to end in September. Also, we don't expect to hear too much from that quarter in coming weeks now that the central agencies are well and firmly in place. Yes, the new agencies have been launched and it's a running start. Winter illness, overcrowded hospitals, workforce shortages now land at the door, mostly of Te Whatu Ora. New Zealand Doctor's senior journalist Martin Johnson caught up with Te Whatu Ora board chair Rob Campbell a couple of days after the official launch of the new agency, which now employs the sector's 82,000 staff and contracts with another 200,000 health service providers. In addition to being chair of Te Whatu Ora, Rob Campbell is chair of the Environmental Protection Authority, of Energy Innovation Agency Ara Ake, and of the New Zealand Rural Land Co. He is Chancellor of Auckland University of Technology. Martin talked to Rob Campbell, zooming into the agency's temporary offices in Auckland's semi-industrial suburb of Penrose.
I'm at our temporary HQ in Penrose. Our office is being established in Manukau in the Kōtuku building, but it's a couple of months away before it's vacated to enable us to go in there.
So that'll be a joint head office in Auckland and in Wellington. Is that how it works?
Yeah, our head office will be in Manukau. Obviously, there's a lot of staff in Wellington because they're already there. And we do need some staff in Wellington, but we will gradually build up the Manukau office. What doesn't need to be in Wellington doesn't need to be there.
So it does mark probably the first big shift of the previously Wellington bureaucracy out of Wellington.
Well, we think it's kind of more than symbolically significant. It is symbolically significant to locate it in Manukau, where obviously there are many health issues, but it will make a practical difference too. It's an intentional shift to try and signal and to shift our focus to where the health system is rather than where the politics and the bureaucracy is necessary as those are.
And was that your doing, or did the government want that?
It was an initiative from us, but there's been no pushback from anyone in the government.
Okay. Well, my first question on my list, it's a bit like a political biography, so I couldn't find a Wikipedia page for you.
Oh, is that right? That's good. I've achieved something then. I was brought up in Upper Hutt. My father left school at 15 and worked for a bank and left there when he retired. It was kind of the generation that was what happened. And my mother was a full-time mother, but also worked in the local primary school at sort of secretarial assistant.
After you left university, so you trained as an economist and worked in the union movement for quite a while.
Immediately leaving being a student, I was a junior lecturer at Victoria and then at Massey. And then I was engaged initially to do some work with the Wellington Drivers Union on a wage claim, and then was sort of recruited more widely as primarily as an economic advisor into the union movement, giving some advice to the Federation of Labour and to the state unions. I was actually housed and paid for by the PSA at the time. Not sure, there's a plaque on the wall for me in the PSA head office, but that's where I was. And then because of the ongoing relationship with the drivers' union, I moved more into a negotiator role with them and the stores union and the retail workers union, which eventually formed the distribution workers union, which I was general secretary of.
I saw that you were a member of the Labour Party. Is that the only political party you've been a member of? And was that sort of a personal choice, or was it sort of part of the job?
Yeah, only political party I've been a member of. I'm not now, haven't been for a long time. But it was a personal choice, but it was kind of part of the job and the leadership of the union movement as well. So I was on the Joint Council of Labour, then I did go on to the executive of the Labour Party and was active in the Labour Party in the late 1970s and early part of the 1980s.
Did you aspire to a political career at that time?
No, never have.
I read Matt Nippert's article about you in the Herald. He portrays you as an outsider, both in the union movement and later in business circles. Is that how you see yourself?
Yeah, it was an interesting discussion with Matt, actually. I mean, I was demonstrably an outsider as a sort of person from, I guess, a middle-class background in a working-class movement. And then as my career morphed into sort of the big business world, obviously my political attitudes and background were not mainstream, to put it mildly. But I mean, it's driven more of a personal thing. I mean, I've been a depressive and an introvert all my life, so I kind of naturally lean towards feeling like an outsider, even if others don't see me that way. But in the big roles, objectively, I have been an outsider here.
He refers to your involvement for a time with Buddhism and becoming a vegan. Is that influential for you?
Yeah, it is. I wouldn't describe myself as a practicing Buddhist, but I still read a lot of Buddhist material and I do meditate. I have a meditation practice of my own. Veganism is kind of more recent, but it arises out of the Buddhist thinking. So yeah, it's influential on me. I mean, it makes a bit of a difference. You don't have that red meat running around in your veins. Got to have some effect on you.
Thinking of yourself as an outsider, to what extent is business and also the business of health, in your view, about relationship between people? And what does being, to some extent, an outsider mean for how you've been able to operate there in business and in health?
In business, it's probably pretty much the same, actually. So I'm still a reasonably intellectual person. I read an absurd amount of material and read very widely. And that influences a lot about how I think. I'm about to go to a meeting of our Te Whatu Ora executive team, and one of the quotes I was going to use was from an article I was reading last night about Che Guevara, which is possibly the first time he's been used as a mentor in the New Zealand health system. But one of the things he's famous for saying is that it may seem ridiculous, but the true revolutionary is guided by the deepest feelings of love. And I'm using that to say that in any change program, you can be quite destructive. and it's particularly important to have those deep feelings of love about the service that you're giving and the people that you're working for. And I think that's an important thing for people in the health system to keep in mind. I'm sure most do. But it's easy to forget when you're in a leadership position, be it in business or in government, there are the exigencies of the daily decisions that you have to make, and you inevitably do get distanced from people in the clinic or out in the community or in the operating theatre. And because you're in that atmosphere, it's easy to think that you have a better clarity of thinking than those people do. It's even possible people do suffer from it, thinking that they're better people than the other people, which of course you're not either of those. You are, in fact, distanced. And because of that sort of outsider thing, I feel I'm probably more used to that than most. I'm more aware of it. I think otherwise it can creep up on you, and it's one of the arrogances of bureaucracy and leadership and organisations that happens without you noticing it.
Obviously, you've been very successful in business, so how have you managed to do that? You've made a lot of money for a lot of businesses.
You don't do it on your own is probably the first answer to that. I think I've been helpful in being able to think about the environment in which businesses are working, thinking about the things that are most effective for them to do, and being able to link people together in that common purpose. I've never been one of the kind of the Milton Friedman business is only about pursuing profit, even though it can be for many businesses. The businesses I've been involved in, you know, have all had that characteristic of wanting to make money, but equally to be successful in a variety of other ways. So, you know, I think that, you know, I've been able to make a contribution. Some businesses I never felt I could make a contribution to, and I didn't stay there very long. You sometimes don't know until you get involved whether this is somewhere where you think you can make a contribution, and I'm certainly not scared of reaching the conclusion that I'm not useful and moving on.
What contribution do you think you can make to Whatu Ora and the New Zealand health system?
Well, I think I do bring a fair bit of knowledge and experience in restructuring and change within organisations, so that is one thing that I bring. I think that I do bring a reasonably unusual blend of knowledge of union organisation and business management, which I think is useful in and will be useful in this immediate period for Te Whatu Ora. And I think I do also bring a breadth of thinking, which I've had the luxury of being able to do, about society and the services which society needs and can provide. Lastly, I'm not afraid with taking risks, and we do have to take some risks in this process.
What are some of the key risks that will have to be taken?
The huge risk is that you make this structural change in the way the health system is organised and it simply doesn't work. Someone described it to me in another context, not about health, as it's always possible that you take the chains off Leviathan and Leviathan still doesn't move. That is possible here. We have to activate Leviathan, if you like, with some of the chains taken off. So that's really the risk of failure, that we in fact can't affect change at the pace and at scale and in the direction that's needed.
You portrayed yourself, I think, at a health tech conference as a new broom keen to sweep out consultants. Who's going to do the work that they do? Because presumably it's not unnecessary work. Is it simply that you prefer to have employees rather than contractors?
Well, first is I'm not entirely sure that a lot of it is necessary. I think the system has had a tendency to look for outside verification, outside support, when often it has had more of the answers within the system, within its own people. And so it's partly about having the confidence. I want to instill in our managers and our staff the confidence that they do know and they can work together and that they don't need external validation all the time. So I think there is some consultancy work which is unnecessary and actually a weakening process rather than a strengthening process. As we build up our system, we build up resilience and we build up innovation. It's got to be done by the people from within. So they need to then have the confidence to know when they genuinely need some external assistance, and that will be getting in contracted and consultancy advice. I don't propose to ban that, but equally, you can become over-reliant on that. It can hollow out your core capabilities. And I hate seeing consultants that are embedded in systems for too long, because what they are doing is hollowing out capability rather than building capability. So I do intend to be pretty forceful on that with our management teams, to look at ourselves, look inside first. And, you know, frankly, I'm not sure if I should say this or if other people would say it, but here goes. I get pretty annoyed when I see senior, very capable people in our system being offered more money to go and work in consultancies so that those consultancies can hire the same person back to us at a margin. That happens. And it not only annoys me, I think it's something, it's behaviour that we shouldn't encourage.
Do you think that's happened in the transition unit? Or is the transition unit a special case in that it was necessary to bring in outside expertise?
There's no question you couldn't have affected this transition process in the time period that it's gone on without bringing external assistance. Most of that work was done before I was there. How much of it could have been done and how much of it could have been done better with people from within the system, I really don't know. But looking forward, I've got this view of the world.
So on Friday at the launch of Te Patu Ora, you had a slightly stern message to state-funded health services, including primary care, that they'll have to comply with the same equity and efficiency and other requirements as Te Patu Ora. Andrew Little, the Minister of Health, has spoken a number of times about his concerns or about what he calls outdated primary care business models. Have you talked with him about that at all?
Yeah, we have discussed it, not in any real depth. I'm aware of him making that point. And, you know, I think that, you know, GPs are really saying the same thing, aren't they? The GPs are saying the current system doesn't really work for us and we're not sure it works for the whole system. I think from my discussions with PHOs, they would all recognise that, you know, they've grown up servicing one system and they know that there are limitations to the way they operate. Certainly, if you go out more into the iwi organisations and other community-based care organisations, they all express varying degrees of dissatisfaction with how it works. So we may not have agreement on what the answers are, but I don't think there's a wide area of disagreement that the primary care sector needs to change. So that's the first thing. From our point of view, we've got really clear instructions from the Te Ora legislation, which will be backed up by the government policy statement, which and that'll in turn be reflected in the health plan. We've got pretty strict instructions about what we have to do, and we don't have a lot of room to move on that. I don't want more room to move on it, but we've got very clear instructions. And in particular, we do have that strong equity instruction, which we have to deliver. So we can't afford just to leave in place a contract or arrangement which is not fostering equity or providing answers to those inequities. We have to change them. So I would have thought what I was saying was blindingly obvious. Some people have said it was stern or harsh or whatever, but to me it's more in the nature of blindingly obvious that A, that's what we're going to do, and B, we're going to do it because we have to.
I think primary care has long said that they want to change. They can't change because the funding model is kind of stuck. It's like an LP that's a scratch on it. It's an inflexible funding model that drives certain outcomes.
So the funding model, it does have to change, in my opinion. This is getting out of the area of my expertise. I'm capable of saying this doesn't work and everyone knows it doesn't work. I'm capable of saying we have to change it. I'm capable of saying we can only change it with the people working in the primary care sector, in particular the GPs. How that is affected, what the real answer is, you know, I'm a fool who rushes in, but I'm not about to rush in and suggest I've got the answer to that.
Whose idea was it that you become chair? Were you approached or did you put yourself forward?
I was approached by the people who were working for the ministers on the process.
Stephen McKernan?
Actually, it wasn't Stephen, but I did have a long chat with Stephen before I took the job. But no, I was approached by someone else and I don't want to really divulge who that was.
Is there anything that's particularly shocked you since becoming chair of Interim Health New Zealand about health?
Yes, I think the dysfunctionality in the system has shocked me, and that's a dysfunctionality between political level and the delivery level, between the ministry and the operating level, and between the various parts of the system. There's a lot of dysfunction, duplication, misunderstanding, and it applies right through to the union organisations. You know, I can sit down and have done with union leaders collectively and individually, and it's some of the most valuable input I get. But most of the time, the relationships seem to be like some version of World War One trench warfare rather than cooperation. And I just use that as one example. I've been surprised at how dysfunctional the old system was. I've got to stop calling it the current system. It's the old system today.
You mentioned relationships there, bad relationships. Have you met any general practice or other primary care leaders?
Yeah, look, a small minority of them because it's such a big sector. But yeah, some I knew from other relationships, some I've met since I started to become involved in this. And, you know, I get really, really good input from them. If I can use a business phrase, everyone talks their own book a bit. I think we're going to have to learn to all think more systemically rather than this is what suits me. This is what suits our organisation, and think more about what worked for the system. How do I adapt to that? So I think we've got to change the nature of that conversation a bit. But, you know, no secret to you or anyone else, the people who work in primary care or in the hospital level care are all dedicated people. Very few people are there to make a fast buck. If they are, they've made a bad turning somewhere, haven't they?
Mm. Bad relationships that you're talking about at all levels, between DHBs, between DHBs and the government, between DHBs and unions?
Yeah, look, you can see with the DHBs some areas where they were not cooperating at all. There are some areas, you know, take Health Alliance where I'm sitting at the moment, where you know, cooperation has produced some efficiencies. People struggled to get over the inherent dysfunction of a 20 DHB structure and the various funding structures that apply, the huge number of contracts that there are, the fact that individual entities have often quite a large multiple of contracts which don't necessarily gel together and fit together, which don't necessarily gel and fit with the contracts which other people doing similar work have. The dysfunctionalities are systemic, and that affects people, you know. The people are good, the system is bad, is the way I think about it.
I noticed that there were two interim Health New Zealand board members who weren't appointed to the Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand board. Andrew Little asked him to comment on that. He said some gaps and skills had been identified, namely around infrastructure development and primary care. Was it you who identified those gaps for Andrew Little, or was that a wider process?
We didn't contribute more than peripherally to the appointment process. The board had already identified that we needed to bring in more financial skills, and you know, we do need to do that. That's not a criticism. It's not a reason for either of the people to have left the interim board.
Tell me what you think about the ethnic and gender composition of your board now.
Well, I don't know what it's going to be like when we get the two extra members we haven't got yet. As it stands at the moment, the gender balance is okay. The men are just a little bit short at the moment, actually. But, you know, I don't think that's unfair. Curtis Walker is the only Māori we have, other than Tipa Mahuta, of course, who comes across from Te Aka Whaiora. So I don't think there's any question we're going to get plenty of Māori influence on our proceedings. We have a lot of joint meetings, so I think the balance for Māori is okay. We have lost Lui Goshi as a Pacifica background person, and we'd be very keen that we do have a Pacifica presence on our board. You know, you've got to be a little bit careful with boards. You know, I am for diversity and balance in boards. You know, we get a lot of, oh, my group's not represented. And people need to understand that good governance is not really conducted by a group of people who see themselves as representatives. They have to see themselves as working for the whole system, not representing one bit of it. So I'm less concerned about such and such a category being represented than I am people who are listening and empathetic to all those things. But, yeah, gender and ethnic composition are important. And as I say, we're okay at the moment, with the exception that we obviously could have better multi-ethnic representation. Hopefully we might get some more of that.
Final question. You said earlier, I think, that you weren't afraid to walk away from things if they weren't working out. What chances do you give of success in your current role, and how long would you give it before you'd walk away if you didn't think you were meeting your own targets for success?
Look, I'm very committed to this. I've given up most of my other roles, certainly my other private sector roles, in order to do this. So it's a big commitment on my part, and I won't be easy to budge.
That was Martin Johnson talking to Te Whatuora Health New Zealand Board Chair Rob Campbell. It's not the first time we've seen an experienced business person from the private sector take the reins in health. National's 90s health reform saw a number of senior posts taken up by private sector business folk, and more recently, former Director General of Health Chai Chua took a similar punt with the senior management team at the ministry. Some moved on within months. As Rob Campbell notes, the sector's dysfunctionality comes as a bit of a shock. It likewise has proven not easy to budge. That's it for now. If you have any issues you would like me to follow up on System Fix, please drop me a line on editor@nzdoctor.co.nz. Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you would like to learn more about the health reforms and other issues in primary care, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor, Rate Aotearoa, on nzdoctor.co.nz. Or to keep up with issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications now offer monthly subscriptions. Thank you to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix. This is Barbara signing off. Until next time. Thanks for listening. Nga mihi nui.